Happy 4th of July to you. I'm Veronica Rickert with you today on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm in today for Kathleen Dunn. The 2008 Summer Olympics are just around the bend, with new stories waiting to be told. In the history of the Olympics, some stories, though, have stood out more than others, have become the stuff of legend. And that's our topic this hour, as we take a look at the article, The 15 Greatest Moments in Olympic History, from Mental Floss magazine. Our guest this hour is Ethan Trex. He is contributing writer to Mental Floss. And we're hoping to hear from you as well. Tell us what stories have stayed with you over the years. Maybe you've heard about some that we'll be discussing today. What's your take on these stories? And which athletes have inspired you? Why do we get so invested in the individual stories that emerge from the games? The number to call is 1-800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234. Or email us at talk@wpr.org. And Ethan Trex, thank you so much for being with us today.
Hi, Veronica. How are you this morning?
Good. How are you doing?
Fantastic. Thank you.
So tell me, how did you ever get a handle on the entirety of the Olympic history to pick these stories?
I read a lot of Olympic history. There are several really great books out there that just have pretty much event by event for every Olympic Games, what happened in each event. And just kind of, if you go through and read enough of those, it seems like every fourth one has at least something that's really weird or offbeat, or somebody did some bizarre thing to try to cheat. So it's really fascinating to go back and read through the history of all the games. And even if it's not something truly bizarre, you often hear a lot of just really inspirational stories about people who've overcome a lot.
Are you an Olympics buff in general?
Not really. I wasn't until I started writing this. Until I started writing this story. Now I'm super excited for the 2008 games.
And we should point out here that the title of the article is The 15 Greatest Moments in Olympics History, but we're not talking necessarily about the lofty moments. We're sometimes talking about the ignominious moments, too.
Oh, definitely. But, you know, a lot of the great stories that everyone knows from Olympic history, you know, even the more recent ones, you think about Michael Phelps at the last games just destroying everyone in swimming. That's stuff that everyone knows, but what you might not know is that maybe At those same games, there was a swimmer who couldn't really swim, and that's sort of more interesting.
Well, speaking about swimmer who couldn't really swim, talk about the first one on your list. It's called the debut of the 100-meter dog paddle.
Okay, when Juan Antonio Samaranch was in charge of the games, he was the last IOC president, he kind of implemented a program that was trying to spread the Olympics to more underdeveloped parts of the world, try to get the Olympic spirit out to maybe some countries that wouldn't ordinarily have seen it. And due to this, there were these wild card qualifiers where maybe if you weren't a world-class athlete at a certain sport that you wouldn't have been able to go through the normal avenues to qualify for the games, you could still come in and represent your country. And this was it was a really good idea. It was a good idea for inclusiveness, and it was really a key to getting a lot of people in other countries excited about the games. However, there were some little kinks with it. So in the 2000 games, Equatorial Guinea sent a swimmer named Eric Musambani to do the 100-meter freestyle. And the problem was that I guess in Equatorial Guinea there aren't that many swimming pools and swimming isn't a big deal there, competitive swimming. So he'd only been training as a competitive swimmer for about 8 months. And, you know, Olympic pools are 50 meters long, right? And he'd never been in a pool that was more than 20 meters long. So he was kind of behind the eight ball already, and he'd never really swum in competition before, and he'd never raced for more than 50 meters. But in any event, he had to run the 100-meter freestyle. So he gets up on the blocks with in this special heat for these two other wild card qualifiers. So he's between two other guys from other small countries who both fall off the blocks and they get on and get disqualified for false starts. So the poor guy is already having to swim this heat in a pool that's longer than any pool he's ever seen, a race that's longer than anything that he's ever done before. He's having to do it by himself. So he jumps in and he's kind of dog paddling, I guess is the best way to put it. He is sort of struggling. He makes it through the first 50 meters okay. He's going slow, really, really slowly. It took him about It took him almost a minute to do the first 50 meters, and really good world-class swimmers will do the whole 100 meters in under that. So he gets back, and he does his turn, and he gets to about the 80-meter mark, and he just sort of runs out of energy, and he starts to stall, and he just is kind of dog-paddling, stalled out in the water, to the point where on some TV broadcast, the commentators were asking each other, in all seriousness, whether or not someone should jump in and rescue him because he was drowning. So he's in pretty tough shape, but eventually the crowd really, really gets behind him. This is the earliest heat of the day. The crowd really got behind him. He's hearing this roar of the crowd, and finally he just sort of wills himself to dog paddle to the finish, and he pulls out, and he had finished in a minute and 52 seconds, which was pretty much double the time of the everyone else who had run the heat. But instead of being disappointed, he was just ecstatic that he had finished this race that was the length he'd never done it before. By virtue of being the only guy in the heat, he had won his heat, and he felt like he'd had a major accomplishment and represented his country well. It was a really great story.
And he became kind of a celebrity then, didn't he, at that Olympic game?
Yeah, well, this was pre-YouTube, but even now, the clip of him running this race is a YouTube classic. If you look for Eric the Eel, he got that nickname. And after that, he actually was training for the 2004 games, and he became a pretty good swimmer. Not world-class. He wasn't going to win a gold medal, but he got his time down to 57 seconds, which was almost half of what he had done in his original heat, but his visa had gotten messed up for the 2004 games. He didn't get to compete, but he got his fair share of fans. I think he was happy with what he got out of it.
One thing that struck me looking at the picture of him, you've got a picture of him on the starting block that accompanies mm-hmm. the article. He is a really buff guy. I mean, he looks like an Olympic athlete. So it sort of was striking to me that it must be pretty mind-boggling just how the level that these athletes are competing at. If a guy who looks like this can't swim in double the time.
Right, I think so. I think part of it is probably that when Equatorial Guinea found out they could send some wild card qualifier, they found this guy who was obviously, if you look at him, he looks like he'd be a great natural athlete, and he's a fine physical specimen. So they just figured, hey, this guy can be a swimmer, right? And he seems like he had a good attitude about it, but maybe it didn't work out quite as he planned.
Do you have a favorite story from this bunch?
Oh, that one might be my favorite, but there are so many that are just wonderful. I'm a marathon runner. I really love the story about the first marathon that was run in 1896 at the first modern games in Athens, just because that was really the marathon. You know, it's just something that millions of people do each year now. It wasn't a real race before the creators of the first modern Olympics were trying to come up with something that would really, a race that would really tie in with the history and the heritage of Greece to make something special for the games. And they decided, hey, why don't we do this to commemorate, you know, the famous story of the run from Athens to Marathon, from Marathon to Athens, to this part of Greek history. And they started out, and what happened was that the Greek people, because it was so, you know, it was so intrinsically tied to their national identity, they got really, really into it. And the rest of the world was just kind of baffled by this super long foot race, which at the time was just a completely unheard of distance. So during the first one, the organizers were having trouble even finding 17 guys who could run the race from Marathon to Athens. So they started pulling people in from just other events, guys who had run a long, like, you know, a several hundred meter race the day before. They pulled them in. And it didn't work so well. A lot of guys started having trouble around the 10-mile mark. But at the very end, this little Greek guy who is, you know, he's sort of funny that his actual story is sort of lost to history. People say that he was a farmer or that he, you know, he worked carrying water. But his name is Spyridon Louis, and he won the race despite having stopped midway through, going into an inn and having a glass of wine or two. You know, he had his priorities in line, but he made it through, and he became a national hero and was carried out on the arms of his countrymen out of the stadium, and people were giving him gifts, and he wouldn't accept anything. So he just wanted to go back to his quiet little life and just run on his own.
That's pretty amazing. stopped doing. It sounds like an urban legend. Do we know that that actually happened?
Yeah, that was part of the struggle of writing the story, was that a lot of the stories are from the early Olympics, so you really had to go through, and that was reported in, you know, the New York Times and sources like that. So it seems like it was I feel pretty confident that actually happened. And actually, in Greek, even in modern Greek, I believe the term is angeni louis, which means to become louis, and it still is in modern use in their vernacular to run quickly.
Hmm. Well, speaking of, as long as we're on the topic of the early games, we have an email from John in Milwaukee who's wondering whether what he'd heard is correct, that in the original Olympics in Greece, the athletes competed in the nude. Have you heard that?
Oh, in the ancient Olympics, yes, I believe that is true, yeah.
That would make for a whole different experience on TV these days.
I think the wrestling would be slightly more uncomfortable if we did that.
Yeah, just for starters. Well, there's one in there that I really love, the story of the press sisters / brothers. Can you tell us?
Yes.
Tell us about them.
Well, you know, during the Cold War, the Olympics, you know, when we think about Cold War Olympics, we always think about the miracle on ice, with the U.S. versus the Soviet hockey. But it was pretty much gamesmanship between, you know, Eastern Bloc, Western, extended to all the games and all the events, even the ones that normally you wouldn't give much thought to. So in the 1960 games in Rome, there were these two, I believe they were from Ukraine, Soviet sisters named Tamara and Irina Press, who were just these enormous hulking women who were fantastic athletes. At the 1960 games, they became the first sisters ever to win gold in the same Olympics. Tamara was a hurler. She set the Olympic record in shot put, and her sister Irina won the 80-meter hurdles. And then at the 64 games in Tokyo, they blew that out of the water. Tamara won both the gold in the discus and the shot put, and Irina won the first Olympic pentathlon. So they were... These were serious, serious athletes. They were also enormous and really strong and had a lot of masculine physical features and deep voices. And the Western press hit on this idea that they were not actually women, that they were brothers. This was before gender verification had been implemented by the game. So if you showed up and said you were a woman, you were competing as a woman. So this was something that the American press really jumped on and said, oh, look at the Soviets, they're cheating, they're sending these men to compete as women. So that you know, rumor-mongering got worse, though, because in 1966, the International Amateur Athletic Federation decided that it was no longer going to be that you would just say, okay, I'm a woman, I'm going to compete as a woman. They started doing what's known as gender verification, where they would have a doctor look at you to determine whether or not you were a man or a woman. And at that point, the two sisters promptly dropped out of the 1966 European Track and Field Championships and didn't say why. They said that they weren't going to compete, that maybe they were going to go to take care of their mother, who was ill. But the Western media, you know, kept calling them the press brothers, and it's still a mystery why they quit. Maybe they legitimately quit because they wanted to go take care of their mother. Maybe they were men. Maybe they were women who had been shot full of male hormones. It's sort of a mystery.
That's so interesting that you can't, even to this day, this was not that long ago, I think they first came on the scene in 1960 or so, but we still don't know. You'd think someone, an intrepid journalist, would have tracked them down.
Well, they were still, you know, they were national heroes in the USSR because they were these champion athletes. I know that one of them went and became an officer in the KGB. I'm not sure what the other one did, but They were well taken care of for the rest of their lives, and they were national heroes there. So I think that was probably they could stick to their story, and maybe it was true.
Yeah, it's interesting because you start reading the article, at least I did, and I thought, oh, come on, you know. And then you look at the picture and you go, it's not altogether clear, is it?
It's not altogether clear from looking at them because they're very, very muscle-bound women, and at the same time, they were so much better than everyone else in the field that I think if you watch them, that, you know, with Tamara setting all these shot put and discus records, you would think, gee, what is her advantage? How is she so much better than everyone else out there? So
well,
I feel like maybe you just need some explanation.
Well, not even just, you know, the muscles. We've all seen women bodybuilders. That's not that unusual these days. But there's something about the way they're built which just looks very different. Maybe it's the outfits they're wearing, though.
I think maybe it is. I think probably early 1960s Olympic track and field garb was maybe not the most flattering.
That seems a safe assumption. Well, interesting story there. And we'll be back to hear more stories from the article, The 15 Greatest Moments in Olympic History, with Ethan Trex. He's a contributing writer to Mental Floss magazine. Tell us, have you heard some amazing stories from the Olympics over the years that have stayed with you, maybe even from more recent games? And why do we get so invested in these stories that emerge from the games? The number to call is 1-800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234. Or you can send us email at talk@wpr.org. I'm Veronica Rickert here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up at 1 o'clock today, join us for Talk of the Nation Science Friday. After 1, join Ira Flato as the talk turns to baseball bats. There's talk of benching maple bats from the Major League Baseball games. Find out why and what might take their place. And then it's on to bottled water, bottled or tap. Take a look at water and why the source matters. That's 1 o'clock, Talk of the Nation Science Friday. Veronica Rickert back with you on the 4th of July as we take a look at some of the greatest moments in Olympics history with Ethan Trex, who's a contributing writer to Mental Floss magazine. That article, The 15 Greatest Moments in Olympic History, appeared recently in Mental Floss. We're hoping you'll give us a call today as well and tell us what stories have really stuck with you over the years from the Olympics. Maybe you've heard about one and you want to see if our guest knows that too to get a little more detail. We can do that. And also tell us why you think we get so involved in these stories. The number to call is 1-800-642-1234. And Ethan Trex, we've got Antonio on the line from Madison. Let's go ahead and talk to him. Hi, Antonio.
Hi, how are you?
Good, how are you?
Great. I think it's a great, interesting conversation and topic. The record that stands in my mind, I'm curious, I'm sure it's been mentioned, it's Bob Beamon's long jump record. And I guess the thing that really amazes me is, you know, you can't go down the road of enhancement, any kind of steroid enhancement or drug enhancement. It was one of these things that people were watching, the jumps were all going on, and all of a sudden this guy goes 2 feet further than anybody else, and it was almost defies that moment of happen. How could that possibly happen? I mean, it's beyond like, okay, was he on something or not? It was just, you know, people have tried to explain that record and how that happened, and, you know, it's just one of those really, really unique and an amazing accomplishment considering what had happened. I'm curious his response to that or thoughts on that.
What year was that, Antonio?
Got me. I want to say, boy, he would... Your guess would probably know. I want to guess the 60s sometime, but I have no idea. It stood for years, that record. Again, I can't speak to it. I don't know the details.
Hmm. I think it was Bob Beamon in 68 at Mexico City, right?
I believe that is it. And it was 29-something. I don't even remember. But I remember one thing. It was clearly beyond anybody else by a couple feet, I think.
Yeah, he beat the world record, I think, by over 21 inches. And the really great thing about the story is that I think, yeah, he barely qualified for the finals because he had fouled in two of his qualifying runs. So he barely sneaks into the finals, and then he comes out, and he is the first person ever to long jump 29 feet. So he blew everyone out of the water. And I can't remember how long the record stood, but it stood for ages, 23 years, yeah.
Do we know?
So he did it.
Do we know where that jump came from? Is it just sort of one of those magical moments that happens at the Olympics? Or had he repeated that in practice?
I think that was probably just one of those incredible moments where all of the conditions are right and you're really excited because it's a game and you make it. Because he beat the world record by almost 2 feet. So even if he had been able to get close to that in any sort of practice or trial, he would have already owned the world record. So he dug down deep and found something, which happens in the Olympics.
You said you're looking forward to them this year, especially. Are there stories that you are aware of that might be unfolding at the games that the rest of us should know about?
Well, I was actually really disappointed because yesterday, Brendan Hansen, the backstroke swimmer for the U.S., he had had this great rivalry with Kazuki Kitajima, a Japanese swimmer, at the last games where they had gone back and forth and had a pair of showdowns in the 100 and 200 meters, and he just got upset, actually, yesterday in the trials. He came in fourth in the 200 meters, but they'll still be able to face off and see who's better at the 100 meter. So, actually, I'm sorry, I said backstroke, he's breaststroke.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I saw that one on...
That could be a fun.
Anything else?
You know, right now, it's still all sort of coming together. Everyone's always excited for the gymnastics. I think after watching the trials, seeing Shawn Johnson do so well and being just so poised that she could be a huge story.
What was her name?
One of the big American histories. Shawn Johnson.
Shawn Johnson, okay. Yeah. And as long as we're on the gymnastics, there's a great story from the article about the Japanese gymnastics team. A guy named, I think it's Shun Fujimoto, do I have that right?
Oh, yeah, that is right, at the 76 Games.
Right, yeah, tell us a little bit about him. It's an incredible story.
The Japanese men's gymnastics team was really a dynasty in the middle part of the 20th century. From 60 to 72, they won the team gold at every Games. So by the time the 76 Games rolled around, they were going for, I guess that would be their fifth in a row. So this was really sort of a matter of national pride and honor that they were going to win this. But the Soviet team was also really, really good that year. So they didn't really have much of a margin for error if they wanted to win the gold medals again. So Shun Fujimoto, who was one of the members of the Japanese teams, was doing his floor exercise, and he felt something kind of go wrong in his knee. I think he said that it felt kind of like he had a pocket of air in there, that something had torn. And he had actually broken his kneecap, but he knew that he needed to stick it out and be out there so the team could win. So he didn't really tell his coaches or his trainers. He just went back out on this broken kneecap, which is really an excruciatingly painful injury to walk on, much less to be doing competitive gymnastics on. So he goes out and he gets on the pommel horse, and he scores a 9.5, which is a fantastic score, even though he said that he was, you know, blinding pain in his knee. So the next event that he had to compete in was the rings. And obviously you've seen the rings. You're hanging up, suspended in the air. And, you know, this was his strongest event. But the thing is that when you're done with your routine, you do a dismount, you know, where you fly through the air and do some spins or some twirls. And then you land on your feet and try to stick the landing, right?
Mm.
So it's hard enough to walk on a broken kneecap. He was having to fly through the air and then land on one with all of his weight. So he gets up and he does the rings, and he does a triple somersault and then lands on the foot with his bad knee in a perfect landing. He gets his best ever score. He scores a 9.7, is crying. After he gets his score, he just collapses from the pain. He tries to walk away, falls down again, and at that point he gets withdrawn from the competition by the doctors after they realized that something is seriously, seriously wrong with this guy's knee. And the physicians were just amazed that this guy could walk or even maintain consciousness when landing on his knee and not just passing out. And the Japanese team rallied around him, and they barely edged out, I think by maybe a tenth of a point, the Soviets, and they won the gold again.
That's astounding. So he's got this broken kneecap, and not only does he not drop out, but he sticks the landing, which I can't, just reading about it kind of makes me wince. You know, it's amazing that the heroism and the reserves that people seem to summon up in these moments.
The Japanese team especially, there are a lot of great stories. There's another one in here that I really like that I wrote about at the 36 Games in Berlin. Two of their pole vaulters, a guy named Shuhei Nishida and another one named Suo Oh, were locked in this really heated battle for second place for the silver medal. And it was getting dark, and they kept going, and really neither one of them was asserting himself over his teammate. And at the end of it was declared a tie, their competition. So, but to get the medals, one of them was going to have to accept a silver, and one was going to have to take the bronze. So they worked this out among themselves. Oh took the bronze, and Nishida took the silver. silver. But when they got back to Japan, they realized, hey, we tied, we're teammates, this isn't right that one of us should have one medal, one of us should have the other. So they went to a jeweler, got the two medals cut in half, and then had the pieces soldered together, where each one had a medal that was half silver and half bronze to honor their tie. And they've kind of become icons in Japan. I know that one of them is on display at a big university. They're known as the Medals of Friendship because they are, these two guys were buddies, and they just wanted to have they wanted to have something that would commemorate not only what they'd done, but also their deep respect and friendship for each other.
Yeah, it's a beautiful story. I wonder if the Japanese team is looking strong this year. Do you know?
You know, I really don't. I know, like I said, I know they have some really strong swimmers, but I'm not sure about everything else yet.
Let's take a phone call now. We've got Ed on the line from West Allis. Hi, Ed, you're on the air.
Well, it's always interesting to look at athletes and analyze them in terms of gratitude. And the best gratitude that I've ever seen from an athlete after a victory was when Katarina Witt bested Debbie Thomas in the 1988 Olympics in Calgary. It was the year of the Battling Carmens, if you remember. And she actually went back to Germany and thanked the workers for subsidizing and supporting her. And in the whole history of sport, that has happened only one other time, when Nolan Ryan entered the Baseball Hall of Fame in Cooperstown and talked about his trials in the off season trying to find employment. And Mr. Ryan thanked Marvin Miller at the time of his induction into Baseball's Hall of Fame. And I think if you want to talk about just a pure story of championship, you should also talk about Muhammad Ali's, or at that time Cassius Clay's, victory in the 1960 Olympics in Rome, and the fact that his medal is sitting now at the bottom of the Louisville River.
That's in the article, actually. That's an amazing story.
I'm sorry. Right. After Cassius Clay won the gold medal at the 1960 Games in Rome, he'd sort of become this already. He was an international celebrity because, you know, he was such a great character, even at such a young age. When he was only 18, he was still a quote machine, and still he was going around trying to meet everyone that he could. He'd never really been out of the country, so he was trying to, you know, make friends, learn what he could, and the journalists just loved him. And the Soviet press especially would sort of bait him, because they realized, hey, here's this guy, he kind of talks loose, we'll get him to say something incriminating about the U.S. And he was always, you know, even though he was such a jovial character, he was always really savvy, and nobody could get him to say anything to slag on the U.S. My favorite quote that I've got in the article, someone, a Soviet reporter asked him how he felt about, you know, representing the country when, during segregation, there were still restaurants that he couldn't eat, or de facto segregation, there were still restaurants that he couldn't eat at home, and hoping, you know, that would fade a good quote out of him. And his response was, Russian, we got qualified men working on that program. We got the biggest and prettiest cars in the world. We got all the food we can eat. America is the greatest country in the world. But I think that part of that sort of came back to bite him when he got home and he tried to go into one of these restaurants that you know, he would usually have been banned from because of his race. And this is in Louisville, and the proprietors just weren't having it. And he was, at that time, wearing his gold medal, which he was so proud of, around his neck pretty much 24/7. I think he was maybe taking it off to shower, and that was about it. And this gang of white guys tried to pick a fight with him for being impotent and trying to eat in a whites-only restaurant. And I think they were pretty summarily dispatched, as one is, when they try to pick a fight with Muhammad Ali. But after that, he said that he was so disappointed, and he saw that the medal had lost its luster, and it didn't really mean anything if it couldn't, you know, prevent a situation like that from happening. So he took it off, and he chucked it into the Ohio River. But no one knew where it landed, and he just didn't have a medal for almost 36 years. When the Olympics were held in Atlanta in 1996, the Olympic Committee gave him a replacement medal during halftime in one of the U.S. basketball team's games. So he got to go out and pal around with the Dream Team. And, you know, he got a replacement medal and seemed pretty pleased with it.
So is that the end of the story? He's got the replacement medal. Did anything ever come of the medal that was chucked in the river?
No one knows what happens. And some people contend that maybe it's an urban legend, that maybe he just lost the medal.
This seems kind of unlikely.
I know that during NBC's coverage, when he was getting the replacement medal, Bob Costas said during it that maybe that it wasn't that he had thrown the medal into the river. Maybe the medal had just been lost, or maybe it was, you know, a metaphorical chucking into the river. But no one knows what happened to that medal.
Someone might have an interesting find someday diving to recover the
right.
lost medal. Well, let's take another call now. We've got Walter on the line from Port Edwards. Hi, Walter.
Hello. How are you doing today?
Good. How are you?
I have a little background on Bob Beamon's long jump record in 1968. A few years after that, his jump was analyzed in one of these sophisticated sports research journals, and it was analyzed, and they surmised that all the conditions were just right. The rarefied air in Mexico City and his run-up, the maximum speed, and everything just came together for this very fantastic jump.
Hmm.
And I'm sure nowadays, with all the technology, you've watched some of those sports programs on TV where they analyze athletic performances, and they can analyze it right down to the, you know, fraction of an inch. But this was not that sophisticated back then.
Well, thanks a lot for calling with that.
Can I add a little trivia?
Yeah.
Does anybody know when Bob Beamon's record, long jump record, was broken?
No.
1991 at the World Championships in Tokyo by Mike Powell. And I happened to have been at that meet. I was working in Japan for the U.S. government at that time. And I was at the meet and experienced a world record.
What did it look like?
What does it look like?
Does it look like they're hanging in air?
Oh, absolutely, at 29 feet. Oh, yes. Yeah, but in fact, that was Bob Beamon, Powell and Carl Lewis had a fantastic jump-off. I mean, both of them were jumping in the 28s, the whole series of jumps. And the whole stadium was just crazy because when each score was posted, people just went crazy. It was a real neat event.
That must have been amazing to be right there.
Yes, it was.
You know, I've always regretted that I never got into the Chicago Bulls until after they were past their heyday. I've always heard that watching Michael Jordan jump was like watching something that wasn't possible according to the laws of physics. Have you seen him jump, Ethan?
Oh, yes. He's incredible. Seeing him play live is one of the greatest things I've ever seen. It's unreal. Just his grace, and also he defies gravity. He's not human. He's something else.
Well, maybe we'll have to watch these Olympics and see if we see moments like that. Well, thanks so much for calling, Walter. And we're going to take a quick break right now as we talk about the 15 greatest moments in Olympic history with Ethan Trex, contributing writer to Mental Floss magazine. Hoping you'll be calling with your favorite stories from the Olympics today as well. Tell us what stories have stuck with you and why we get so invested, so excited about these stories that come out of the games. The number to call to join us is 1-800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234. We have an open line for you right now. You can also email us at talk@wpr.org. I'm Veronica Rickert, and you're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up at 12:30 today, stay tuned for Chapter a Day as Carl Schmidt reads Crossing to Safety by Wallace Stegner. And at 1 o'clock is Talk of the Nation Science Friday as the conversation turns to maple baseball bats and why they might be getting benched from Major League Baseball. We're back now talking with Ethan Trex, contributing writer to Mental Floss magazine, about the article The 15 Greatest Moments in Olympic History. And let's go on and take a call from Jeff in Waupun. Hi, Jeff. Thanks for calling.
Yeah, thank you for taking my call. Yeah, we have a family story, and I was wondering if he's got any records as to whether this has been a true story in the past or if there's any records that exist. We had a member of our family during the Cold War from East Germany who had won an event, a track and field event. I think it was a 100-meter dash. And she got the gold medal, but instead of going to ceremony, she defected some way. And I was wondering if he's got any stories in regards to that.
Hmm. No, I don't. I've never heard that story. That's a great story if it's true, though.
I think so. I can research it a little bit further, but and check it out. But it's this particular individual is pretty elderly right now, so I don't have a whole lot of information on it. But we've heard it down the line through our generations.
Well, maybe if you have the name, you can leave it with our call screener, and then if our guest wants to follow up, maybe for an article down the road, he can.
That would be great. Yeah, I'll have to check on the name because I know her married name, but I don't know her maiden name. So.
Okay, well, thanks for calling with that, Jeff, and we'll see if Keisha can take some information from you on that.
Great, thank
all
you.
Right, thanks a lot. And speaking, this isn't not quite the same thing, but of course, we've got a boxer in the article. I can't remember his name right now, but who had opportunity showered on him that generated from the Olympics, but he chose instead to go back to Cuba and lead the life there.
Oh, yes, Teofilo Stevenson, the Cuban heavyweight boxer. He sort of burst onto the scene at the 72 games in Munich, and a lot of people sort of saw him as this Cuban version of Muhammad Ali. He was also a really big guy, really strong puncher, and he was also handsome and really charismatic. So when boxing promoters saw this guy, this is someone you can hang your dreams on. Also, he was completely dominant. He beat his first opponent in 30 seconds at those games, and at the end of it, when it was time for the finals, the commentators were joking that instead of sending the guy who had won the other semifinal out into face him, they should send the loser as punishment. His hand was that strong that people, opposing boxers would say that you wouldn't see his left hand until it was on your chin and then you were on the ground. So he pretty much just marched right through and tore down everyone in the heavyweight division in the 72 games. And normally for the way Olympic boxing works is you're an amateur, you go to the Olympics, and if you're really dominant and really great, that's how you become a pro boxer. You make the jump to the pros after that. You sort of prove yourself and make a name for yourself. And that's obviously where the big money is. So after these games, he was just, people were clamoring to try to get him to sign on. And he said that he didn't want to do it, that he didn't want to go to the U.S. to box. He wanted to just stay in Cuba and keep studying and keep up with the spirit of the revolution and, you know, just keep doing his thing. So he continued training for the 76 games in Montreal and was even more dominant there, to the point where afterwards he was getting offered $2 million for a fight, and Don King, you know, the infamous boxing promoter here, was really hounding him and all over him. And instead, even after he got his third straight gold medal in 1980, he decided that he would retire from boxing and go back and work in Cuba as a boxing consultant and trainer for young guys. He had an apartment that he was given by the Cuban government, and he got $400 a month after he had turned down, you know, several million dollars per fight. And when asked about it, he said this great quote. He said, what is $1 million against 8 million Cubans who love me? He wanted to be a national hero. He didn't want to be rich.
That's an interesting story. Someone who really went the other direction, didn't pick up on all the endorsements, didn't go pro, but he sounds as though he ended up pretty fulfilled.
Yeah, I think he had a long life, and he loved teaching boxing to young guys, and he was about as happy as he could have been.
Well, we've had a caller who wanted to know if you can also tell, and we touched on this before, but we haven't told her story, the story of the Dutch equestrian who had gotten epilepsy. Can you tell us her story?
Oh, yes, Lise Hartel. She was, in 1944, she was one of the better equestrian dressage riders in the world. Dressage is sort of it's known as horse ballet, I think, as it's one of its nicknames. It's sort of, you take the horse out and show it, and you do certain maneuvers. It's not like a race, but it's an equestrian event like that. And she was one of the better dressage riders in Europe. but she was taking some time off because she was pregnant. And while she was pregnant, she fell ill with polio. Apparently, she just all of a sudden was having trouble breathing one day. And she miraculously gave birth to a healthy baby daughter, which in itself is just a major achievement for someone with such severe polio. And the problem was that after that, she couldn't walk because of the disease. But she gradually, by teaching herself to control one muscle at a time, got back to where she could walk with crutches again, which was really sort of a minor miracle and was not something that the doctors expected. But within 3 years, she was riding again, even though she had lost all feeling below her knees and couldn't really control her feet or her calves. She could have somebody put her on the horse, and then she could do it all. So she made it to the 1952 Games as part of Denmark's contingent, and she won the silver medal, which I think she might have been the first. Actually, yes, the 52 Games were the first time ever that women could compete in equestrian dressage. So she was not only had been through all this terrible hardship with the polio, she was also the first woman to win a medal in the sport. And there's this great image from the medal ceremony, because she obviously couldn't walk very well. You know, it's sort of a staggered podium to get up to receive your medal. Henri Saint-Cyr, the Swedish rider who had won the gold medal, helped her up onto the platform, and they had a nice hug and embrace. And then they came out again in 1956 at the next games, and Lise Hartel once again won the silver medal. So she got two silver medals in a row, both times coming in second to Henri Saint-Cyr, who had helped her out and had a deep, deep appreciation and respect for her.
All right. Now let's take another phone call. Thanks for sharing that story. And take a call now from John in Germantown. Hello, John. You're on the air.
Well, the two stories that stick out for me is with Jesse Owen when he was doing his long jump. Apparently, the Munich judges were faulting him. You know, try to disqualify him. And one of the German competitors dropped a handkerchief at least an inch behind the jump line. Big white thing, so that he jumped from behind that, so they couldn't fault him. That's one story that sticks out. The other was from the 68 Games, a marathoner. He ran like 5 hours, just incredibly slow. And his quote afterwards was, "My country didn't send me to start a marathon, but to finish one."
That's a good point.
The question I had is there anything going on with the shooting sports? Because as a man in his early 40s, it's the one sport where a 40-year-old actually takes the gold once in a while, like in 96.
Oh, there are so many great stories from the shooting sports because, like you said, it's something that you don't really get too old to do it. As long as you can see the target, you're going to be in great shape. I'm not sure for this Olympics what the real emerging shooting sports stories are. There are so many good ones from old Olympics. There was one that I really loved from the 1956 Games from the Canadian team. This didn't actually make it into the final version of the magazine story, but as you might know, when the guys are doing rifle shooting, you have a certain amount of time to get all your shots fired out at the target, right? Because it's a precision event. You need to take your time, hold your breath, make your shot, right? So in the three-position small bore shoot, the Canadian team was having trouble. Gerald Riette was having a problem because his gun wasn't really functioning very well. So the Canadian coach and team, they sort of huddled, and they decided that Riette and his teammate, Gilmore Boa, would just share one gun, that they would have to both shoot twice as fast so they could get in under the time limit, but they would work together and they would share a gun. So Boa, the guy who owned the gun, went first, and he matched his own world record. He scored a 5.98, which means that he only had two shots that weren't bullseyes out of 60. He then handed the gun off to his teammate, who he was going to let borrow it, and set the world record by shooting 60 straight bullseyes for a perfect score. So they won gold and silver while working together, you know, hurriedly, but doing it together with the same rifle.
Was there ever talk about why that happened? Do you think the pressure of having to shoot fast sort of took the mind part of the equation out of it?
I think that was part of their speculation afterwards, was that they were both obviously good shooters. Boa already owned the world record, but I think that once they realized, okay, you got to focus a little bit more here because you're pushed for time, that probably helped them a little.
Well, and John brought up Jesse Owens, and he shows up in your article as well, The 15 Greatest Moments in Olympics History, as someone who kind of stuck it to Adolf Hitler.
Right. Well, the Munich Olympics in 1936 was, you know, the big story from that was that, you know, Jesse Owens came over as an African-American guy and really showed Hitler, okay, maybe this idea of racial superiority isn't going to hold water, because he dominated the Olympics by winning 4 gold medals. But those Olympics were also just strange in a lot of ways. Winning in the Olympics was a really, really big deal to Hitler. Just personally, it was a huge deal to him. So, and he didn't really care if they cheated or not, or if there is, you know, shady backdoor dealings going on. He just wanted to get the medals. Another great story from those Olympics that sort of illustrates that, in one of the cycling finals, a Dutch rider, Arie van Vliet, was about to overtake this German rider, Tony Merkens, for the win. And the German rider pretty much just swerved, bumped him, and knocked him off the bike. So ordinarily you would think, okay, this is very blatant cheating. This will disqualify you. You won't get the medal. The guy that you knocked over will win the gold medal. But because it was such a big deal to the Germans and to Hitler personally that they win every medal they could to prove their superiority, instead the German rider who cheated got fined 100 Deutschmarks and got to keep his medal.
That's not right. And we knew, obviously, Hitler does. You don't really need to say much about what he is, but I guess I hadn't realized he was also a creepy lech. You have a story in there about him singling out one of the athletes and inviting her up to his box where he proceeds to hit on her.
Right. Helen Stevens, this American sprinter from Missouri, was just sort of a good old gal from out on the farm, and she really just wanted to win. Well, after she dominated everyone to win the gold in the 100-meter dash, she got a message that Hitler wanted to meet her in his box. So really, she was in no position to say no to this. So she walks in, and Hitler throws up the Nazi salute to her, and she says that she countered with a good old Missouri handshake. And he then pinched her on the rear and asked if she wanted to spend the weekend with him, because she was a true Aryan type. And she, you know, rightfully declined, but he apparently enjoyed athletes.
Not a good story. I'm glad she got out. And we'll take a call now. Paul Inchitek. Hi, Paul. You're on the air.
Well, thank you for taking my call. I'm wondering if you can flesh out the story. I recall as a wee lad watching, I believe it was the marathon in the 60 Rome event, where the apparent winner collapsed mere yards away from the finish line. No one helped him because they thought if they helped him, that would disqualify him. And eventually, a few minutes later, another runner passed him and won. Do you recall that?
Oh, I don't recall that, but that sounds like something that could definitely happen at an Olympic marathon, because almost all of the great Olympic stories, or every Olympic marathon has come up with some sort of great story. But, yeah, I've never heard that one, but that's a great story.
You do have kind of a story along the same vein where I think it was in a boat race where one of the contestants stopped to help a couple of other sailors who'd gotten themselves in a jam, and he ended up losing the race.
Oh, right. In 1988 games in Seoul, South Korea, Canadian sailor, his name was Lawrence Lemieux, he was doing really well in one of the legs of the, I can't remember what class, he might have been a fin class racer, but he was really clipping along, he was in first, he felt like he was doing really well, he thought he was going to have the silver medal locked up. But the seas were really bad that day, and even though he had this great lead, he noticed that in nearby water, a two-person boat carrying part of a Singaporean team had capsized in these six-foot seas, and one of the guys was being swept away from the boat while one of them was sort of hanging on for dear life to the capsized boat. These guys were obviously in trouble. So Lemieux decides, okay, there's no reason ever to worry about winning the race now. I got to save these guys. So he reverses course, goes over, yanks both of them out of the water. So now he's got three people in his one-person boat. He obviously can't win. He has to sit there for, I think it was almost an hour, to wait for a rescue boat to come to pick these guys up. And then he restarted the race, and he finished way back. He had gone from, I believe, second place to 23rd place in the race. And obviously his hopes for a medal were pretty much dashed. But the Olympics decided that the Olympic Committee decided that, you know, for something that's so heroic, we're not going to let you leave empty-handed. So they gave him the Coubertin Medal, which is their special award for sportsmanship that I think only a few dozen people have gotten throughout history. And when interviewed afterwards, Lemieux was very firm that he had done the right thing, that he didn't even have to think about it. He said that, you know, the first rule is always that you help someone who is in need or in trouble, and you don't worry about racing.
Well, Ethan Trex, thank you so much for joining us this hour. It's been great.
Thank you so much.
Ethan Trex, contributing writer to Mental Floss magazine. And I want to take a moment now to say goodbye to a dear friend of mine, Randall Davidson. Today is his last day. You'll hear him all over Wisconsin Public Radio, including after this hour, on All Things Considered, Simply Folk. Randall, we'll miss you. Thank you. Good luck.